Joe, do you like to play games?
Yeah. Peter says you have the best games.
Well, I have a game in my house that you might like to play. Would you like that?
Yeah. Okay.
Welcome to this continuation of the Stephen King Night Shift retrospective series.
This will be the best ride of your life, Marty.
Join Garrett.
You did this!
Matt.
I am God here!
And Adam.
This is bullshit, a whole bunch of bullshit.
As they continue to dive into each movie adaptation from King's short story collection, Night Shift.
I am a man of my word.
Contained in this leg of the Stephen King retrospective are the adaptations of Graveyard Shift.
There ain't no way they're going to get this place settled in a week.
The three Mangler movies.
Like I told you, there's no free lunch, no siree, Bob.
And the two Lawnmower Man films.
This is also on you.
Keep checking in as the boys will continue going through each cinematic adaptation of the popular author's work, one movie at a time, in publication order.
How can you do this to me?
All coming up, courtesy of Percolated Media.
I'm in!
Stephen King's Graveyard Shift. Released October 26, 1990. Budget on this was $10.5 million. Box office, $11.6 million. And this was directed by Ralph S. Singleton. Yes, we have taken a break from King. The last King we did was a theatrical release. We did The Boogeyman, which is from this set of short stories, the Night Shift collection. The set that was really my breaking point in thinking, should we or should we not do this series? Because this is the one we're going to slog to get through. The good news is we have three stories left to do. The bad news is we have about 15 movies to do based on those three stories. To go along with this journey, I have the gentleman who we just went through The Exorcist together. We fought on the Star Wars prequel shows, the one and only Matthew Goudreau. Matt, how are you doing, sir?
Very disappointed, because when I heard we were doing Graveyard Shift, I thought we were talking about the hash-slinging slasher on SpongeBob.
And the poor gentleman who we are slinging through this entire retrospective, the mostly King virgin, the one and only Adam Bunch, my best friend of 30 years. Adam, how are you, sir?
I'm back for more King, everybody.
Well, it's good to know he watched the movie. All right.
Or,
Graveyard
or
Shift.
Or Pet Cemetery or any other King.
Well, I mean, Pet Sematary does play a role in this movie, because as we have mentioned every single time we have picked up King once again, we have to talk about this, where King was in the lexicon of pop culture when these movies had come out. This was right on the cusp of a big height of his. He had released Pet Sematary the year before. That did really well for him. Paramount released that, and then they were aching for more. So they picked up Graveyard Shift. They rushed this out. This was optioned by a producer, and that producer had originally hired Tom Savini to direct it. And Matt, you're aware of Tom Savini, great makeup effects artist. For some reason, it didn't get off the ground, so Savini left that, did the Night of the Living Dead movie, the Night of the Living Dead remake, which came out that same year. And since there wasn't any studio interest, the producer let the rights lapse. They were then picked up by a guy named William Dunn, who bought them for $2,500 while working as a location scout on Pet Sematary.
God dang.
$2,500, yeah.
The three of us need to start doing some Google searches.
You're not kidding, man. God damn, we could adapt it for that. And like I said, Paramount rushed this out because King was riding a wave at this point. They had released Pet Sematary. Earlier this year, they had done It. And then a couple months after this, they would release Misery, which would earn Kathy Bates an Oscar, which we'll get to when Adam's kids are in college. So that's where we stand here. Now, Matt, how familiar were you with Graveyard Shift before we started this retrospective?
Never seen this before. This is a first-time watch. I've read the short story. I couldn't tell you next to nothing about it outside of the fact I know the ending is different, which is kind of a calling card for a lot of these adaptations. But I've had to start judging these short story adaptations instead of like a 10 out of 10 scale, which is what I'm contracted to do. I almost have to judge these based on, okay, was this a successful adaptation as far as justifying taking that short story and turning it into a 90-minute movie? That's kind of the metric you have to use for some of these adaptations, because the story is flimsy, and it's kind of a, you know, it's a good bottle story for what it is. You know, it's predominantly one location. I mean, this is, but I think this would have been something that would have been much better as like a piece of one of the Creepshow movies. Reading it, I'm like, I don't see how you turn this into a 90-minute movie.
Yeah, I read it a few times. Once right before we got on the line. And I was the exact same way as you. I'm thinking, God damn, who the hell reads this and thinks, you know what, we could put this as a 90-minute movie. And especially around this time, Matt, we had Tales from the Crypt out there right now. Why not put this on Tales from the Crypt?
Yeah, we were getting anthology horror stories were starting to become popular again.
Mm-hmm. Adam, my best friend, sir, how much did you know about Graveyard Shift before we told you about a week ago, well, you better watch this before we record?
I knew this existed because I think I have seen this title on video stores when I was young and streaming services since those existed. It used to pop up in my Netflix DVD queue, what we think you would like to watch. Yes, they used to ship out discs. Everybody, Google it. So I've known about Stephen King's Graveyard Shift, and I specifically will use that title because that's how I've always known it. I only knew it was a short story when we started discussing these, that it was a part of it, and I'm still holding off to buy this collection of stories until we're through, and I do really want to read it. I knew of it. I knew it existed. It also felt like a kind of a bunch around that time that have Stephen King's name attached to it. Stephen King's this, Stephen King's that, Stephen King's this and that. Which, actually, Stephen King's this and that sounds like a great little anthology series he should put together.
Yeah.
You know, but it's like Stephen King's Thinner. It kind of melded together where it was forgettable. I had no idea what it was about. I've never seen it before, obviously. Never read it, as I just said. But I went into it with virgin eyes, ears, and thoughts and was really interested at least to know. But I'll say, putting the author's name at the title of something to sell it always starts me off on a bad foot. Always.
Always?
Including The Exorcist 3, which some people just discussed. I think it's a selling point as opposed to trying to sell a movie. So I always go in with some skepticism when they do that.
What about when John Carpenter used to do it? Were you okay with that?
That's
he wasn't an author.
No, I know he wasn't an author, but I'm just trying to get the line here.
You know,
of where
I will
you stand
say
on
John
that.
Carpenter himself is a selling point for me.
All right, well, better example. How about around this time, Bram Stoker's Dracula or Mary Shelley's Frankenstein?
I will give you 50-50 on
those. But and they also weren't alive to defend themselves.
Yeah.
Well, it's like the only one, because like, it wasn't John Grisham's The Client or John Grisham's The Pelican Brief. It was just the title of the movie. And you want to talk about derivative. You talked about VHS, this cover, grabbing you as a VHS, like, at Blockbuster. I swear to God, they looked at the videotape for Evil Dead 2 and said, oh, just take that.
Oh, come on. I love the cover of this. That skull with the hard hat on it, that was a nice selling point for me when I was a teenager. And to go back to you, Adam, the Stephen King's, and let's not forget, again, we were riding the wave, you know, Pet Sematary, big success.
Oh,
Stephen King's It, massive success on TV.
I understand the reasoning for it. I mean, that name alone should bring in enough to cover the budget. So I get it from a marketing standpoint. As a younger viewer, it would have excited me if I was into King, as it did excite me when I was into your examples like John Carpenter and things like that. As an older, let's just say, get off my lawn type of grizzled, angry old man, nope.
It's more like riding the bullet, not riding the wave, for the record.
Or the silver bullet.
Oh, nice reference.
Thank you.
I do find it interesting, though. Rob Reiner did not put Stephen King's name on the top of Misery before that came out. So there might be something to that.
Good point.
Yeah, well, all the minis, like Stephen King's It, Stephen King's The Shining.
And to me, it makes sense with a miniseries or a TV movie. And I think maybe that's what it makes me feel like when you have Stephen King's Graveyard Shift, is it feels like something you would see as a TV miniseries, a two-night special.
As far as the short story goes, this was the third short story that King had ever been paid for. He sold it to men's magazine called Cavalier for a grand total of $200 was how much he sold the story for.
I love that he got famous by selling these to Stag Mags.
Uh-huh.
There was something, there was something horror dirty about that you would never have nowadays.
Absolutely, yeah. And you know, it was included in that Night Shift collection. And I mean, come on, Matt, you've read Night Shift. Between this and the movie we're going to talk about next week, we're going to talk about a lot of textile mills in the next month.
Yeah, certainly not. I mean, I'll save it for when we get to it.
All right. So just one more note. William Dunn did bring on Ralph S. Singleton to direct this, who was a TV producer and director. He had directed a few episodes of Cagney and Lacey, and he had worked on Pet Sematary as a producer, as well as a few George Romero productions. So he was brought on to direct, and the original scriptwriter was brought back from the previous regime. And we'll talk about a lot of the changes that he made, because you do have to make changes when you make a 20-page story into a 90-minute film.
Yeah, you gotta pad it out.
Yep. All right, so we hear some thunder, and we cut to a textile mill. Bachman Mills, to be exact. Get it, guys? Bachman Mills.
Yeah, I got that one.
There you go.
Yeah, because...
Oh, you got it.
Yeah,
nice.
That reveal had to be thrown into the shredder.
Yes, we're seeing wool being manufactured. As this is going on, rats are running amok around the main machine. We see someone shut it down, and we also see that it is upwards of 100 degrees in this place. This gentleman says hi to a rat he named Doris and starts cleaning a wound that he got from hitting the wall. He looks up and sees a whole horde of rats just looking at him. And I'll go ahead and say, that is kind of a creepy image to me. It's not from the story. There's nothing in the story that alludes to this. But I do think when he cuts up and we see all these rats just looking at him and we think they're plotting something, that's a little bit creepy.
It is. I had no idea what this movie was about. I did not watch the trailer beforehand, so I'm completely ignorant to all of it. I'll say, though, my first thought is, please don't tell me this is a 90-minute rat infestation movie. That's my first note. But it's creepy, watching all these beady little eyes kind of bearing down on you while you're here overnight. It's amazing how this textile mill makes me think of something that we're going to discuss kind of shortly with the mangler. I don't know why I just tie those two together looking at the machine.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's a creepy, dark, claustrophobic type of feeling right away.
Yeah, and it should be said, too, King did write this story while he was working at a textile mill. He would sit at this mill, he would work the graveyard shift at it, and yes, he would not necessarily sling cans at the rats, but he would throw Pepsi cans at the rats. So there is a little bit of biographical stuff going on here.
This is one of those dumb white people movies, because I'm convinced none of this shit would be happening if they just left the rats alone. I feel like they're out of their way trying to harm people or work as a hive and push them into the textile, the wool shredder. They're just minding their own business, but yet, even though everyone in this movie are in their 30s and 40s or beyond, they still act like high school bullies.
Oh, God.
Like, even King couldn't do that with adults. He couldn't resist it. But this is a good opening. Like, it's kind of claustrophobic. You feel the heat. And there is something unnerving about just seeing a horde of rats just staring at you. But I sat there going, oh, please don't let this be a 90-minute remake of Willard.
I thought of Ben, but there's a nice reference, too. He looks at the rats and throws two of them into the machine to make an example out of them. The sound of the rats fill the soundtrack, and the guy thinks his boss is behind him, but it's actually a huge creature that we can't see who bumps the worker into the machine, and that is our pre-title sequence. None of this is in the book. This is all made up for this movie, but that gets it off on a bloody foot, at least.
End credits.
One, I think, as opposed to Stephen King's Graveyard Shift, I think this movie could be called Diet Pepsi's Graveyard Shift as many times as they focus on that label. But it works for me. I don't know exactly what's going on. It's funny, because, of course, I put the note down and I make a joke that this must be a rodent of unusual size. I'm doing the ruse from the Princess Bride, for those that know that. And you know what? Taking it to Reiner. But I don't know exactly what's going on. I don't know what this creature is, and I don't know the rest of it. But it's like, you know what? I did not have to stop it here. I'm like, okay, let's keep going. This sucked me in. If this wasn't part of the book, I think they did a good job in adding something that would bring you into the town and into the world that wasn't there.
We get some titles over a graveyard, probably some footage left over from Pet Sematary before we go back to the mill and focus on an actor that, Matt, amazing, you and I have reviewed two movies from this actor within the span of a couple months. They both took place in the same year. We just finished reviewing Exorcist 3, and here we have Brad Dourif, here billed as simply the Exterminator. And I want to go ahead and say, you could have cut this character out of the movie and not lost a thing. He has zero impact on this plot.
Fair point, but he's also the only actor in this movie who looks like they're trying. Everyone else looks borderline comatose, especially the main actor. Holy shit. I don't understand, because this is not a character from the short story, as far as I remember. And this is basically, I don't know, was this before or after Arachnophobia? Because he's basically John Goodman's character.
This was right before, because Arachnophobia came out in 91, so.
Because that's who I was thinking of. It's that same kind of borderline insane. I think it was Ride of the Wind might actually be the same year. I think they're both 1990.
We're getting a remake of it.
Yeah, and it's weird that he's uncredited, but yet he's given a name. He's credited as the Exterminator, but they use his actual character name.
Yeah.
Which is weird. But he's the only person in this movie I actually thought was giving a performance.
Really? Earring and all?
Oh, I love... I don't know if it's just because we were watching wrestling. Why is he dressed like Shawn Michaels? He's got the pony. He's got the ponytail. He's got the cross earring.
To Matt's point, he stands out. He's having fun. He's trying. But he's so disconnected from the rest of the film in tone and style and over-the-topness that it feels like they plucked him from a different set, which they likely did, and just put him in here. It's amazing that, you know, when I saw Brad Dourif, I was like, Brad Dourif, no way. But he's ultimately forgettable in the grand scheme of things. So he's, to me, he's more of a distraction than a benefit to this film.
Yeah, I'm with Adam on that. Again, he's not from the story, and I'm not one, and we've mentioned this as we cover these movies, I'm not one who wants you to stick strictly to the book, but this character, like I said, he has zero impact, and he does have a fucking Quint monologue later on, which we'll get to,
which does.
Is fucking bizarre.
Yeah, I'm like, did someone tell Brad Dourif he was in a sequel to The Deer Hunter?
I know, right?
And I'm listening to him talk, I'm like... Who does he remind me of? I'm like, oh my god, he's doing a Woody Harrelson impersonation. If you listen closely enough.
Wow, I didn't put that together.
I guess to their point, I mean, if you know you're going to stretch this out, you got to make it longer, and you get Brad Dourif, that's who you're going to pad the time with. That's who you're going to give audiences more of.
I mean, what a year this guy had this year. He had this, he had Exorcist 3 that we talked about, he had Child's Play 2, he had Spontaneous Combustion. I mean, this guy was working a lot in 1990. All genre stuff.
The year after, he was in Child's Play 3, he was in Jungle Fever, and he was in Body Part.
Oh, I forgot he was in Jungle Fever. We see a drifter walk up and hold the door open for two girls leaving. He walks into a diner, and he's already getting picked on by the townies. Hey, guys, at least it's not greasers.
They're not greasers, but it's the same frickin' diner from Maximum Overdrive.
I thought it was.
I got that feeling, too.
I thought it was fun to be back in Salem's lot.
I thought all the vampires only come out at night.
This is all stuff added for the movie. In fact, that story does not have one female in it that he mentions. So we're going to get some females in this story. We're going to get a lot of action in this fucking diner. And it's like every time we turn around, he's back here.
And from,
you know,
from what I learned or read, we had a lot more with the females, and it all got edited out of the final cut of this film.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the stuff they included is nothing but abuse and them just being borderline assaulted. So much of this movie feels like a sleazy exploitation movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't say that in a good way, by the way, because I don't feel like this is elegant trash. I feel like this is just, well, we have a Stephen King property, and they padded the shit out of this more than Robert John Burke's suit in Thinner.
Which we're going to get to before long. To Matt's point from earlier... This guy, they got to play this main character. I mean, Blandon McBlanderson. He has zero charisma. He is just nothing more than something to get the plot moving forward. He is, spoiler alert, he is the last man standing at the end of this film. And God, I have zero feeling towards him.
It feels like some characters we've had in other Stephen King works where it was Drifter or Return to Townie or something like that. So to me, it's kind of par for the course. But I'm actually drawn to this one more than I have been some of the other ones in his other films. So, I don't.
No kidding. You didn't get any Emilio Estevez vibes from him? I kind of did.
Oh, same character. Completely. But I also think, go back to how I felt about Emilio in that one. You know, I was not a fan. But I think he does a decent enough job here. I'm actually going with it. Maybe because I had similar hair at this time.
You did.
But I'm going along with this one.
We're then hearing some bad Maine accents as we're hearing, oh, God, this is bad. As Warwick comes in and authorizes a cleanup for the July 4th holiday. And you know what? It took me about half of this movie to realize this was not Fred Ward.
Oh, he's the detective from Monster Squad.
Yeah, he's the dad, isn't he?
Yeah, he's Del.
Mm-hmm.
Del.
And I don't know if he was told to bring this accent.
Yes.
I don't know, because no one else has it. So why would he be the only one who does it unless he was the one who was like, you know what, I want to do this. And the director was like, okay.
I thought that was purposeful, and the implication was that he was a foreigner who bought the mill.
Mm.
And that was going to be the justification for why he's such a piece of shit and also why he talks like that. But for something that pads the runtime, they don't explain shit.
They don't. And this guy is a complete fucking asshole. And in the book, he's a company man. He's not exactly a nice guy, but he's not doing things like, oh, let's say raping his freaking employees like he does in this movie. So the fact that they made him this big of a scumbag is kind of curious to me. So Warlick is having his pick of women to have affairs with. The Drifter, whose name we learn is John Hall, says he showed up via Greyhound.
Even that feels like it came out of an AI generator. That's how lazy so much of the storytelling in this is. John Hall? Like, I mean, that's fine if you reveal, like, it's an alias, and they mention he's on the run.
Yeah.
I thought the reveal was going to be that he murdered his wife, or she died because it's Stephen King.
Well, they do mention his wife, don't they? They mention he was married.
He says that she died when he's in the car.
Yep.
John Hall says he's here for a fresh start, and Warlick is hesitant to hire him because, as he says, there are no guarantees with a Drifter. He says he knows how to run the picker, and Hall is given the option to run the picker during the graveyard shift for minimum wage to start. We cut to inside the mill as bland hero Hall opens a bag of wool, and I have to say, not since I watched a Rob Zombie movie have I ever felt and smelled the bad hygiene leap off the screen. Not sure if that's a compliment, but geez, this place just looks like it stinks. This movie is gross. And I'm not talking about gory, I'm just talking about every time I see these people on screen, I mean, I just smell the sweat off the people in this movie, and all the machinery and everything, it's all old and rusty, it just does not feel clean in any way.
So you're saying that you want John Waters polyester, where they give you a little scratch card to watch alongside the movie?
No!
You're right, it feels like the dead heat of summer. But even when he's by himself, I don't feel like he's in danger because he's not doing anything wrong. Because, like, you get the sense the only reason the rats messed with that opening guy is because he killed their brethren. You know, this guy's just doing his job. I thought they were going to set up that some kind of explanation for either the rats or this was built over an Indian burial ground because, again, Stephen King. I thought there was going to be something that would spook him.
To the point, for a cheap movie, and, you know, as I said before, it feels like a cheap made-for-TV type thing, the setting and the placement, that the set design, I'm down with it. Yeah, it gives me that smelly, hot, dirty feel, and I think it's a good place to set this type of movie.
You can tell this movie's cheap because they use the same exterior shot for the mill at nighttime 3 times.
It's
yeah. And by the way, Matt, did you recognize another gentleman in this movie who would go on to some horror success?
The guy, the long-haired guy?
The guy from The Wishmaster, Andrew Dabbaugh.
Yeah, I know him from Air Force One.
Oh, that's right. Hall sees some mice and throws a Diet Pepsi can at them, as well as slingshots some sticks at them. I wonder if this comes into play later.
Why are these people so mean to these rats? The rats are heroes in this movie.
You know what? As somebody who works subway in San Francisco Bay Area, and I've had to go underground before dawn, as soon as you turn on the light, rats just, they fuck off, they leave you alone, they go into back into the walls, just leave them alone, you're fine.
You deal with rats?
I don't want one as a pet, but just leave them alone.
Again, everything's connected. It's like Last Crusade all over again.
Right? Exterminator Tucker introduces himself to John, and we're getting more Dourif crazy talk, saying his infested place is with mice and that Warwick is ignoring it all.
I'm convinced all of his Vietnam stuff is just because he inhaled all the gas from his equipment, and he's just making all this shit up.
He then starts explaining a scene that I think we saw when we reviewed Fast and Furious 2, Matt, about a rat that made its way into a human.
That's a deep cut. And you're right. I mean, this main actor makes Paul Walker look like Laurence Olivier.
We're getting more shenanigans with the shift workers, and Warwick asks for his work order as Jane turns down Warwick's advances. We see another guy make his way down the catacombs of this building, and one thing I have a major problem with is this director's inability to tell or show us where the hell we are. How many levels does this building have? Why are we dressing the same set, pretending we're on another floor? Later on in this movie, we're going to do battles, and every time I turn around, they're going lower and lower and lower and lower. It's like, how many levels are we going at here?
He also only has one directorial trick, and that's have someone go by themselves. You see a shadow move, the camera goes up close, they turn around, and they die. This movie might as well be a slasher movie. It's so cut and paste.
It really does feel like a slasher movie, for sure, especially towards the end.
Mm-hmm. When it does, and I think it's supposed to feel that way. Yeah, one of the issues I have is the continuity with this warehouse, workplace, whatever it is, because it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But if I was watching this today in a movie theater, I'd be a little more upset with it. Watching it on TV and feeling like I'm watching a late 80s, cheap budget B movie, I'm okay, and I'm actually part of the dirty claustrophobia. Yes, this is a Keaton movie. Yes, this is Adam. This is Curran. I am not under my duress, under any duress whatsoever. I'm going along with it here. Like, I'm not hating it. Don't get me wrong. I'm not loving this, but I'm not regretting my decision to watch this like I have some other films.
Wait till next week. So this nameless guy, he sees what looks like a huge bat as it takes him out, and you guys are absolutely right. We are definitely in a slasher film. Hall is getting more shit from the townsfolk as he wraps a plate, and it has a literal rat sandwich on it, and we hear Jane say to him, "Bastards."
And this is when some of the iconography that they're trying to use here, because when they're using a rat this way, I'm trying to think that they're calling him a rat, because there's some union speak that doesn't really go anywhere by the end of this. So between that, and then I'm thinking that we're going to fight a giant rat, but then I see the bat wings. Like, this is when some of what they want to put in here just doesn't line up.
You just put way more thought into this movie in the 30-plus minutes we've been talking about it than all of these writers did while they were coming up with the concept, I think.
Apparently, this place has also not been sanitized by the Board of Health anytime soon, because there's that guy who buys clam chowder and there's rat hair in it. Mm-hmm. I'm like, if people see this clear as day, why would you eat there? I guess this is the only establishment in this town.
That's what I got out of it. And it's just one of those things where if you have a place and you're dedicated to the place, you're going to keep going to it, and you know they're going to treat you well, but these people who come in and quote-unquote take over your town, and I've been in this situation, I've mentioned it before, for about 5 years I lived in a town that was so small, and this is exactly how people treat people who are just coming in here that they are not familiar with. Now, I didn't see stuff like the hair and the rat in the sandwich and stuff like that, but they do just scoff at new people who come in, especially if you're drifting out from out of town. It's just one of those things where it's an ownership thing. And again, they would go there because they're treated right, but these people are not. Jane, of course, offers to take John home, an offer he takes, much to Warwick's chagrin. We're hearing that Hall is from West Virginia and that every town has its share of assholes. I wonder if this includes Jane's town of Castle Rock, that she just kind of drops out of nowhere here.
Another moment where I look like Leonardo DiCaprio in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I'm like, I get the reference. I get it.
This is like when people in, like, Supergirl, when they have to name drop Metropolis or Superman. Because it's like, yeah, this is part of the universe, but we got to find a way to jam it in.
It's Batman or Robin. This is why Superman works alone.
We get an awkward part of the conversation as Hall tells Jane that his wife is dead as he gets out of the car.
Yeah, what a way to end a conversation.
I know! We cut to Warwick taking in another worker who's obviously here to clean up the mill. So not only is the diner not sanitized, but neither is his mill. And with 4th of July coming up and an inspection coming up, this is all in the book, by the way. The 4th of July stuff, that's all in there, where he's going to assign these people to clean this thing up with these hoses, and here we are. But the large creature's blinking eyes tells us that he won't be long for this world. He puts his headphones on as Warwick tells him the fellow who started this job, quote, didn't work out. So are we here to think that, now within the confines of this movie, not the story, that Warwick is sending this thing after these people? Matt, did you get that out of this?
I thought it was going to be like he was like the familiars for vampires, where he's like, in order to keep the mill up and running, he has to take out anyone who is either like from the union or lawyers. There's the part where he blackmails Brad Dourif. I thought there was going to be some kind of explanation for why this guy is such a dick. They don't explain anything. They don't explain the rat. They don't explain the super rat we see later on.
I thought we were going to get to the point that he needed to occasionally feed somebody to this creature. To Matt's, like, familiar point. And that's what I thought. It was just going to be every now and then something needs to be sacrificed to the ruse down in the basement of this mill.
Borderline is threatened by Warwick as she says that he can't put her down there because she, quote, knows things. Borderline is saved by Hall, of all people, as Jane takes her away, and Warwick says the show is over and orders everyone to go back to doing what they were doing. Warwick drops in on Hall's work and says he'd like to thank him, and he offers Hall the chance to work July 4th for a little extra money, just as he eats a nice crisp apple. The only clean piece of food in this entire movie, and of course this asshole's the one who has it. We go back to the diner. As Hall is still picked on by the other crew members, they leave the diner, and for some reason the camera lingers on as an old guy finds hair in his soup that Matt pointed out earlier. Hall cooks Jane a nice meal. Great that he can afford it on this salary. And she says that she went to Castle Rock to get married, and after her divorce, Warwick offered her a job as long as she did quote-unquote favors for him. What a Me Too film, huh? Boy, this would get made nowadays.
Yeah, it's like this is the precursor to Secretary.
Again, none of this is in the story. This is all just put on to make this dude just look way sleazy.
Not that Matt's not hoping to get a remake of that movie with the other Gyllenhaal.
Meanwhile, Borderline finds the file that would end Warwick right in his tracks, but she ends up slipping and falling as she's, I presume, eaten.
This weird fall into...
Yeah.
It's like she goes around the corner and suddenly drops into a pool that... Because it's like there's like a black curtain. Like when you go to a haunted house, those like vinyl big old strips like they keep in freezers and shit. Like she turns around a corner and suddenly is falling into water. And I don't get it.
I don't understand the geography of this mill whatsoever. Because it's not like she falls through seemingly an open door.
Mm-mm.
Like, yeah.
It's like she's standing on one edge of the frame, takes two steps, and then the camera cuts to her falling down the stairs. It's almost like there's a shot missing.
It happens numerous times between right here and the end of the movie.
I'm going to kind of give this movie a backhanded compliment. This movie fell right in that weird area of film. We're on the cusp of visual effects taking a huge step forward. Guys, we talked about Jurassic Park. That's when the graphics and computer visuals really took hold. This is 3 years before that, 1 year before T2, and I think for what they have to work with, I don't think the practical effects are bad. Now, when we get to the, I guess we're going to call it what, the rat bat or whatever this thing is. When we get to that, they do a lot of stuff like we're watching Empire Strikes Back and we saw the Wampa walk the walls for the first time and we're just seeing a tracking shot of it just kind of moving across the camera. We get some stuff like that. But I think for the most part, the practical effects hold up pretty well and there's a certain charm to that. Matt, would you go along with the fact that there's a certain charm to the visual effects here?
Yeah, in the same way that like when Tales from the Crypt would do big monsters, it's acceptable within the confines of what they're working with. It's not one of the things I can critique. I just don't understand why it's a rat bat. Why isn't it just a giant rat? I feel like this movie is the white trash equivalent of alligators in the New York sewers, where it's rats under a mill in a small town.
Yeah, and the story, it really says, like, the lower they go, the bigger the rats get. And I don't think there's a big, quote-unquote, boss living down there. He does mention that there's one without legs, and it is really big, and it only appears at the end of the story. It's not like it's taking people out throughout the course of the story. So that's how the story ends on that front. Adam, how do you feel about the makeup practical effects here? I know you're a sucker for charm stuff like this. You were talking about that when we did the Star Wars movies.
I am on this, and, yeah, to Matt's point, it makes me feel of Tales from the Crypt, Tales from the Dark Side, you know, those type of late night shows that I would watch and the type of visuals and effect that you would get. However, this is a movie, but I am watching it with that kind of the Crypt Keeper's suddenly going to pop out at the end of this and tell me a joke, make a laugh, and we're going to move on. Like, that's how this feels, and I think based on that, I'm okay with it, and I appreciate the way that these look more than I think that they're good looking. But I appreciate what they are and what they went with.
That would have been a lot better if the movie ended where it says, you know how it says, under new management, you see the Crypt Keeper walk out and go, rats all, folks.
This is the fourth time he has mentioned Tales from the Crypt in the last 3 months we've been recording. He so wants to do Tales from the Crypt for Patreon.
We're recording this, and
that's the horror anthology they need to start making every year.
They were going to. Shyamalan was behind it.
Yeah,
he was. Yeah.
And then I guess somebody got cold feet or...
Somebody watched Shyamalan's movies and went, no.
I mean, look, if you're going to reboot The Twilight Zone, why not do Tales... I mean, reboot it again. Give Tales from the Crypt another shot. Like I said, this movie's padded. This would have worked. I mean, with this budget and with this... One thing I'll say about Tales from the Crypt, it got much better actors. Certainly more high-profile ones compared to this.
Singleton then makes a really odd cut of mice walking on water as Surfing USA by the Beach Boys plays.
I mean, I guess that's where the budget went.
That's what I was just thinking. That couldn't have been cheap. Warwick walks in on the crew's fun and says that he doesn't want anyone messing with the hose. He says he needs this basement workable by next Thursday, and Hall pops off with, and then what? We get gold watches?
Part of the cleaning on this, and that's why the exterminator part earlier, like, it doesn't make sense. What is flooding them? You don't flood rats out of something like this. So when that fire hose goes into effect and they're doing the other stuff, like, I don't get what it's supposed to do other than piss them off and just show that these guys are assholes.
You know, I was thinking that too, because we're not seeing any holes in this mill or anywhere where these rats are going to be slipping out. So what is the point other than to maybe drown them?
Yeah,
And then clean it up later, but they don't really make mention of that.
No, because by that point, you're going to have to retile everything. You're going to
There's
going to be mold. Like, at that point, you're better off just demolishing the whole building.
Exactly.
I can't imagine he has the budget to afford a full renovation.
We see more executions of rats by Brogan. Now, I'm seeing these characters, like this one Ibsen, who approaches Warwick, and he's from the story. And I just have zero investment in anyone. Although, Adam, you're still with the main character here, aren't you?
I'm with the main character. I'm with the foreman, and and he's going to show up to give some instruction and to leave and be an asshole. I think he shows up to tell you not to be careful when you cross the rod. But, sorry, impersonations are Matt's job, I apologize.
That was pretty good.
At least everybody stands out enough. You know, you got the asshole foreman, you got the female that I think is going to be here till the end, you got Ponytail, you got not John Belushi acting like a dick.
You got the smoking black guy.
Yeah.
Right? I was like, we watch Police Academy all of a sudden? So everybody at least is identifiable, but nobody makes any sense either.
Matt, I'm guessing you're not invested in anybody here.
Not entirely. And that's one of the things where I think the short story is where King's strength as a writer is, because he's good about giving you character details without a whole lot of exposition. Here, they give you the details, like, with this quote-unquote romance, if you want to call it that, and it's not interesting, and it's the worst example of, all right, stretch it out. Stretch it out is what this production feels like.
Oh my God, we're going to be talking about that through all of the stories in this retrospective. They're going to stretch every single 10-page story like it's a fucking rubber band. Warwick kicks Tucker's dog, because we need to see this guy be a dick again, and then sends Tucker to a graveyard to clean the rat stool in order to avoid being named in a lawsuit against Bachman Mills. But we hear Moxie, his dog, being taken out as Tucker is smashed with a casket. So here's the end of Brad Dourif.
Did the caskets make any sense whatsoever?
No. No, and none of this is in the story. I don't know if it's just because they want a visualized graveyard shift, but this is really stupid to include this.
Guess what? We're going to get more caskets as well, and the entire time I'm thinking, did I miss something on Max? Did they skip over something where this mill is built on an old graveyard where we flooded it so much that these have come to the surface? It just, I don't know why they start showing up.
Why is the cemetery in such close proximity to this mill?
I know! I thought of that too. Unless, like I mentioned, it's just a leftover set from Pet Cemetery, and they were just like, fuck it. Although this was a time, you know, a lot of King productions of his stories did take place in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
It's just really bizarre to include this, unless they just wanted to include some part of horror iconography that didn't involve rats. Meanwhile, Hall finds the trap door from where the rats are breeding, and then Hall insists on Warwick going with them. Warwick laughs at this and says, we're all just one big happy family. To which Jane says, yeah, the Manson family. Brogan falls into the sewer water below and is taken out by the creature underwater.
Huh? Because we're walking on a perfectly good floor until we take that one extra step, and then we're in a full lake that doesn't make...
Yeah,
and this is where, all right, we can't get this puppet to maneuver around water whatsoever, so just pretend to drown.
Like Luke Skywalker fighting the Dianoga all over again.
Carmichael, the token black guy that Matt mentioned earlier, he makes the dumbest move you can make in a horror film and sticks his arm in a long dark hole without seeing what's on the other side. And he gets his arm just chopped right in half. Some good gore here, I'll give it that.
This is a good gore, it's a good little moment, and when he pulls it out, that stump, it's just like, it feels so just sickly textile. It's just, ugh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it looks good, but from here on out, this might as well be a Friday the 13th movie.
I was just about ready to say, this is Jason Underground, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is Jason instead of a psychic hell worm, he's a giant rat.
Warwick saves the Wishmaster, only to eventually get eaten by the creature, as Hall and Jane reveal a corpse that's in a casket they're carrying across the river.
I mean, literally, this is the Last Crusade. I think they're going to flip this upside down and breathe underwater. I'm waiting for that to happen.
Warwick falls amongst a bunch of bones and then just goes on a warpath, attacking Hall.
What?
We get a really long fight as they go back and forth until Warwick stabs Jane when she approaches them. So you were thinking she was going to last the whole movie, Adam, and she's gone, and not by the rat, but by Warwick himself.
Yeah, and I was, I'll say, it got me. It, one kind of cool little reveal down here. I couldn't tell with the way that I was watching it. It looked like a matte painting, and I appreciated just the scope of what they made, suddenly this underground that makes no sense to this mill looks like, and just piles of bones that would make Vlad Tepes proud. This is an impressive set down here. I just wasn't expecting it whatsoever. And once the fighting starts, I figured they're going to start breaking up shards of bones and use them as weapons, which is what they do. I wasn't expecting her to die. I figured the two of them would be crawling out to sunlight, the rats would scurry away, and they'd at least subverted the expectation that way.
When did you see Matt Paint? Never mind.
Jesus.
That fell flatter than the box office returns.
Than the Diet Pepsi that's down here.
I was surprised, but I'm also just, okay, so we got a concussion and went crazy. I don't understand what's happening here.
You figure the three of them would at least be like, okay, mortal danger. There's a creature to kill us. We all got to get out of here together. Nope, I'm going to sacrifice y'all so that I can get past the monster.
And for 1990, this Jane broad is not bad looking, too. So,
no, she's not. She at least has a little more to her than some characters in these type of films. Not much, but...
Yeah, she's got some charisma to her. She will stick around. She'll work in TV for a while after this. Warwick then comes face-to-face with the creature as the guy even bites the wing as he falls, and the creature just devours him, and Hall just sits and nods his head.
It's a rat. It's got bat wings, and I swear at one point I saw what looked like a scorpion stinger come into play. I don't understand what this creature is. I think maybe we're going to get a full shot of it at one point, then I realize it looks like Jim Henson's creature design on crack. We're not going to get a full-blown, but... It's a creepy creature.
This is what happens when you leave your creature design to an author who uses cocaine. Like, people go through coffee syrup.
To be fair, it was not really described in that novel, in that sort of story. I mean, he mentions it, and it's described a little bit, but again, it's not attacking the entire movie, so...
How long have people been getting killed at this mill, by the way? Look at the pile of bones down here.
Yeah, I know, right?
This is where all the Richard Bachman people were buried.
This some creature that came out of outer space that decides to resurface every 27 years?
There you go. That's another movie, sir. Oh. Nice reference, though.
That's two. I'm out.
Yeah, you're up. It's now Hall versus the creature as he pulls himself up, and now he's face to face with it. And these guys have no idea how to film this. The creature attacks as Hall scrambles away, and then we get perhaps my favorite cause of death in any movie I've reviewed for this site. The movie goes ultra slow motion on the Diet Pepsi can as Hall slings it into the picker, and its guts spray all over the ground.
You know, this was the shame with Warwick deciding to paint himself up Arnold Schwarzenegger in Predator style about 10 minutes before. That's what we should have had here at the end. He should have, you know, should have had this Predator standoff, mud on his face. But, oh my God, I can't believe the Pepsi can got the slow-mo.
Yeah, well, it's Diet Pepsi, so this movie shows aspartame is bad for you.
And like I said, in the book... He's not slinging him with a slingshot. He's throwing him. Now, I don't know if this is some executive saying, we need to have some kind of action with these cans that don't involve throwing, because throwing's boring. And we had to come up with this concoction that this guy makes up to sling at this thing, and it's just so fucking stupid.
Well, it's the same thing as It, when the kid hit Pennywise with the silver bullet slingshot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point, and that had come out a few months earlier. We cut to a new We're Hiring sign. As credits roll, and I miss the days when final songs would just consist of dialogue from the movie.
The same thing that I mean, 89 did, where there was that song where they just looped dialogue from the movie. And this also,
I know.
This is also different from the book, the short story, where like the rat kills the main guy, and
yeah, he's dead in the short story. Yeah, graveyard shift. When's the last time you went to the graveyard?
But the final shot of this thing is reminiscent of fucking The Shining. It's like this mill is going to stand on this hill and keep going.
Keep going and going. All right. Scale of 1 to 10. What do we give Stephen King's Graveyard Shift? Adam, as the one who's been way more complimentary than I was expecting, you go ahead and go first, sir.
Oh my God, I walked in expecting to hate this movie, and it may have caught me at the right day. It might have been because I just got back from Universal's Halloween Horror Nights, and I was in the mood. It could have been because I was able to watch it on smaller screens and not a movie theater, but I didn't hate this movie. I also took it at what it is. It is a cheap, low-budget, stretched-out version of a short story. You put this down to 25, 35 minutes and you put it in an anthology, and I think you got something here. Stretching it out, padding it with characters that don't really matter, it's not good, but it doesn't suck. Or at least it doesn't suck as bad as some other things that we have watched and that we're going to watch. It's got potential. I think you could do something with this story, even though this isn't necessarily the way to go with it. I appreciate the practical effects. I think the setting is claustrophobic and eerie and dirty enough that it feels like it's supposed to. And even though I don't really like any of the characters, the cast is small enough and you differentiate enough between them that even the fodder, you can not appreciate, but you know what you're getting with it. It sits there. It's kind of a run-of-the-mill Stephen King story. He's made definitely a lot better, but he's made a fuck ton worse. So I kind of think this is middling for him in middle, and that's where I'm going to land on it. Surprisingly, I'm going to give this a 5, and I can't believe that. And again, I'm giving it a 5 on the King scale for me, because it's one of those where I'm like, you know what? This should have been a lot worse, and I think if they were to redo it, they could make a decent movie or at least episode out of the story. So I'm going to give it a 5 on 10.
Boy, thank God my heart's been fixed, because I would have had another heart attack if I had done this before that surgery. Whew, boy. Matt?
Like I said to commence this show, I think the damning statement I can make about some of these short stories is that when you fail to substantially justify the runtime for the sake of padding, I can't give you a full endorsement. And especially because what's here is dull with the Drifter character, small town. I'm sorry. I've seen all this before, and quite frankly, when you have a premise that involves a giant rat, and I spend most of this movie just on my hands, kind of indifferent, I think that goes to show that this is not one I would endorse in the grand scheme of Stephen King adaptations. But at the same time, I don't think it's one of the worst, because I don't find it either offensive or a bad adaptation as far as just getting far away from the premise, because the premise is still there. But I think the perfect example of this is this should have been, you know, a 30-minute episode of Tales from the Crypt or some kind of piece of creep show. Because as it stands, it does drag for something that's 80 minutes, and what's here is not particularly impressive. This is why I think so many of the best adaptations are the ones that have been done by great directors. I think there's a stark contrast between a Stephen King movie directed by Brian De Palma versus one that's directed by Ralph Singleton, even if the stuff they're actually adapting is of varying qualities. That gives the importance of direction. But it's, eh, you know, it is what it is. I'm not going to outright trash it, but I certainly wouldn't. I wouldn't ask it to work overtime, so I'm going to give this the patented 4 on 10.
A 4 from Matt. Going off that critique, Matt, I guess we're assuming that since we're having Toby Hooper next week, that should be grand. It should be amazing.
Well, depends, because Toby Hooper's only directed one great movie.
Steven Spielberg show up and direct it?
To be determined. I'm not going to sit here and tell you as the fan that this is great. I'm not going to sit here and tell you this is good. I'm going to sit here and tell you, you know what? We are recording this right before Halloween. It's going to be released after Halloween. And if it's around Halloween season, this is not a bad watch. Now, I'm with Matt where the padding really shows, because there's times when we go to this diner and I'm just like, we've been here before. Why can't we go somewhere else? And we keep going to the same spot. And for a story that takes place in one place, I appreciate that we're going other places, but we only go to about 2 or 3 other places, one of which is a graveyard, which, as we've said, makes no fucking sense. This movie makes no fucking sense. This movie is a stalking movie. It's a slasher movie with a giant fucking rat. And let me just give this endorsement. If people love those Rob Zombie movies, you're going to love this movie. I don't love those Rob Zombie movies, but I do like a few of them. I like this movie to a degree, but I'm not going to give it a full endorsement, so I want to go right down the middle, like Adam, and I'm going to give this a 5. I think there's some decent kills here, we got some good Halloween scares, and we have some moments where I'm like, you know what, the parts with Brad Dourif, I can't help but laugh, especially considering we saw such a grand performance in Exorcist 3 just a couple months ago. So I want to go ahead, I'm going to give this a 5. I think it's a decent watch, but don't go out of your way to watch it. At the time we're recording this, it's on HBO Max. Check it out on HBO Max. Don't rent it. All right, that does it for Graveyard Shift. And fortunately, boys, there's no more Graveyard Shift movies. Unlike the rest of the stories that we're going to be covering in this collection, I'm surprised we didn't get a continuation of this mill. Mm-hmm. But Matt, I guess you are kind of happy about that.
Yeah, I wasn't looking forward to Graveyard Shift overtime.
But who knows, maybe that would have dimmed the little bit of a sweet taste that Adam had while watching this. But what will we feel next week where, God, stop me if you've heard this before, we have another Stephen King story that takes place in a mill. Yes, we are covering The Mangler, which stars Robert Englund. It stars Ted Levine and is directed by the aforementioned Tobe Hooper, who is a god amongst a lot of horror fans. We'll get into his resume, which we always do when we cover a Tobe Hooper movie, next week. But Adam, what are you expecting when we talk about The Mangler?
I think I'm going to be disappointed. I'm expecting to be disappointed just because I first time watch, amazingly enough. And I remember, though, growing up as a youngling and seeing the promotion for this everywhere, because it was sold not off of Stephen King, not off the Mangler. This thing was sold off of Robert Englund's face. Huge. And Robert Englund at the time was as big as it could get. I love Nightmare on Elm Street. I love Freddy's Nightmares. I would watch at night. And for some reason, I just never watched it. I think maybe my dad looked at this and went, fuck no, we're not going to go see this. But I remember so much about the marketing and the drive to get this out. But you know what? There's more of these than there are Graveyard Shift movies, so maybe I'll be pleasantly surprised.
Matt, put Nightmare on Elm Street on the schedule right away.
Just the last one. Just New Nightmare.
Oh, God.
I'm not watching that again, I'm telling you right now.
Yeah. Matt, what are you feeling when we get to The Mangler next week?
Dread it, run from it, Destiny Still Arrives. You know, it's on the schedule because it's a requirement, but I'm not excited to be watching this, I'll say that.
It's one I definitely remember. I saw it at, remember, Adam, El Campanile Cinemas?
Oh, yes, I do.
I saw it at that theater when it was released. I was one of about three people in that theater, and I have memories of it, which we'll get into. But yeah, this was the part of the retrospective that, again, we're going to have to push through this, boys. I mean, once we get through these Night Shift stories, I mean, we have some good stuff to cover, a variety of stuff to cover, including even a Arnold Schwarzenegger action film and some Rob Reiner and some Frank Darabont. But man, to get through that, we got to go through a hell of a lot of Korn and these Mangler stories, and we got to go through virtual reality with the Lawnmower Man. So
yeah, they should have called Night Shift these movies the Brown Mile, because it's nothing but shit until you get to, like, I guess the Lawnmower Man is the electric chair, because at least that movie's interesting.
Well, you know what? I was not expecting Adam to give this the slight endorsement that he did, so maybe we'll get surprised. But until next week, when we talk about The Mangler, I don't mind telling you, boys, this podcast is infested. Thank you, guys.
No one could have comprehension and attention at that speed. No one.
I did, Dr. Angelo. As a matter of fact, I think my retention is better at higher speed. Normal speed was only putting me to sleep.
That's impossible.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively on Percolated Media.
Very funny. I'm laughing my ass off.
Join us next week for an entirely new review.
I've synergized a tremendous amount of data, and you and I have proven that most functions of the brain are simply lying dormant, waiting to be awakened.
And if you like this review, please head over to percolatedmedia.net or search your podcast streamer of choice, for we have individual reviews such as Knock at the Cabin, The Black Phone, Megan, as well as additional blockbuster franchises like the films of Martin Scorsese and Leonardo DiCaprio, the DC Extended Universe, Stephen King's ongoing collection, and many more.
I realize that nothing we've been doing is new.
And if you'd like to hear the boys talk about the film adaptations of Carrie and The Shining, please head over to www.bingemedia.net and click the Aftertaste tab.
Way to deal with these fuckers.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Looks like you made the list, Nardello.
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
You need to be led, just like everyone else. It's a basic need.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
Clean up this, Warwick!
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
I ain't one of them burning baby flashback fuck-ups you see Bruce Dern plans to quit your grinning.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
You better watch what you're saying.
I don't think so. I think from now on you better watch what you're saying.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is for review and discussion, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
Now, do you have any idea what a VC rat eats? Try raw American whole mayo, thank you.
As we have mentioned every single time, we have picked up King once again.
Yep.
What the hell was that?
That was my husband in the other room.
Oh, okay.
Hey, Christian.
What's going on? And it was included in that Night Shift collection. And, I mean, come on. Matt, you've read Graveyard. God damn, I keep calling it Graveyard Shift. You've read Night Shift. The sounds of the rats dulled the soundtrack, and the guy thinks his boss is behind him, but it's actually the sound of the rats filled the soundtrack. And Hall is given the option to run the picker during the graveyard shift for minimum wage to start. Or what shift are they giving him, Adam?
The graveyard.
There you go.
Something you're familiar with.
Oh, very much, yes. I know this well. Although, I haven't worked in 100-degree heat.
No, but if you step outside, you would.
You're not wrong. We cut to inside the... As you guys are going to find out here pretty soon. We cut to inside the mill as... Warwick laughs at this and says, "We're all just one big happy family." To which Jane says, "Yeah, the Manson family." Crickets.
That's fitting for this dialogue.
Broken. We are covering The Mangler, which stars Robert Englund. It stars, oh god, what's the name of Buffalo Bill?
Ted Levine.
Thank you. It stars Ted Levine. Until next week when we talk about The Mangler, I don't mind telling you boys, this podcast is infested. Thank you guys. All right.
Ring the bell so Adam can get out of here.
Adam, we'll talk next week, my friend. Yeah, good luck.
Until you put it on the schedule, I never knew Mangler was a King movie.
Really?
I had no idea until we were getting ready for it.
Well, thanks for revealing that now and not on the podcast. Go away.
I had mute on. I actually said it twice. I had to be muted.